This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards in your mobile Apple website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com now. Coming up today, has virtual reality finally gone mainstream and how it ended up with me getting punched in the face on national television? Why languages would live longer if we talked less, and why digital government actually might be starting to make a bit of sense, unless you're a civil servant. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me are James Temperton, acting deputy editor of Wired.co.uk.
Hello.
And Cara McGugan, our superpowered intern.
Hi.
Superpowered?
Well, seemingly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Seeming basically to be able to do everything.
Is that right?
Yeah. So I think that's, you know, you're appearing on the podcast. That's a big step.
It's a superpower.
I'm a bit underpowered today because I can't actually hear very much.
Pardon?
Exactly.
Ha ha!
I spent last night at the Chemical Brothers gig as part of the Apple Music Festival.
That's very young of you.
Yeah, it was really loud. it was really upsettingly loud.
So we were talking about this earlier and you said your friend wore earplugs, but you didn't.
Yeah, I was trying to embrace it. But it was the loudness that it kind of powers through you, you know, so you're holding a beer and you can physically feel it shaking. You feel very transparent.
Does that mean the beer goes flat?
No, I don't know. Well, I drank it quite quickly. But it was the best moment. It was a very good show. But at one point, two giant robots descended from the ceiling.
As you do.
Yeah, and then started to fire lasers from their eyes. And that's just the kind of thing you want on a Thursday.
Pyrotechnics.
Yeah.
Loudness and beer.
Yeah, it was actually really cool. But the crowd was very into it, although we were up in the kind of cool bit standing, attempting to dance, and maybe stuck out a little bit amongst the executives and assembled tech CEOs. But
I like that you say attempted to dance.
Well, I'm not tooting my own horn. But anyway, I'll soldier on and attempt to hear as best I can, because later in the show, we're going to be talking about our exclusive interview this week with Cabinet Minister Matt Hancock, MP, who is the head of the government's plan to digitise everything with a pulse, about why blockchain and Uber are a good model for public services and not the worst idea ever. First, James has been finding out why virtually all the world's languages are dying and if it's the internet's fault. Is it, James?
Is it? Right. 900 languages have been driven to extinction in the last 3 years, and this comes off the back of a UN report that's looking into the digital divide and increasing broadband access. And they claim that a lack of linguistic diversity online might be one of the contributing factors to billions of people still being without internet access.
So how many is 900? How many languages are there? What kind of percentage is that?
So we've got about 7,100 languages which are in active use around the world, but 90% of these are only used by 90% of these are used by 100,000 people or less. So an awful lot of these languages are incredibly small, and in fact they even go down to languages which are only spoken by one person. There's a Peruvian language called Tarachiro, which is believed to just be spoken by one very elderly person.
That's lovely, but slightly sad at the same time.
Yeah, so we're losing about 6 languages a year, but that's despite the number of languages supported online going up, albeit slightly slowly. So there are 500 languages which are localized online. Google search supports 348, Wikipedia 290, Facebook 80, and Twitter 28.
Now, those are officially supported languages, but obviously people can talk in whatever language they want on Twitter.
Right, that's true. And this is where it gets a little bit interesting. So I spoke to a couple of linguistic experts about this, and the UN points out that there's a barrier for online access with a lack of linguistic diversity, but the linguistic experts pointed out that actually people are quite clever when they communicate online. So someone, say, who is Indian might speak Hindi and English and another smaller local language, and they'll use all three when they're communicating online in written form, just as they would when they're speaking in the real world. So it becomes a very difficult thing to measure, and people are almost creating new languages out of these new forms of communication. So linguistic diversity is still very much alive, but there are definitely still problems here. The internet is overwhelmingly English. So according to a survey of the 10 million most popular websites, 55.2% are in English, and that's it.
That's amazing, especially considering a billion people mainly speak versions of Chinese.
Yeah, which accounts for between 2.4 and 2.8% of the 10 million most popular websites. Hindi, which is the native language of 310 million people, accounts for less than 0.1% of the 10 million most popular websites, which is incredible.
Are there fundamental reasons for this? I mean, is it to do with how URLs are written, for instance?
Well, that's one of the problems. I mean, the internet is a Western creation, and an awful lot of this English dominance will be because of the United States and so many of the big technology and internet companies being born out of America. But if you take something as simple as the domain name system, www.wired.co.uk or facebook.com are absolutely meaningless to someone who can only read and write in Arabic or Hebrew or Tamil. Like, you can't see the symbols. They're nonsense, just as I can't read symbols in Japanese. But that's despite domain names being available in other alphabets. So it's a problem to which there's a solution, but it's one that isn't being utilized yet. So there is no Google in Tamil. There is, but you still have to be able to read Google if you're a Tamil speaker.
To what extent is this just sort of continuing a process that's been going on for a very long time, though? Because obviously, publishing as a concept reduced diversity in languages to some extent. It caused us to standardize spelling, industrialization as instructions for how to build machines, or globalized economies meant that things could only be written in certain ways in certain languages. I mean, that's partly why people learn English anyway, because the media, movies, radio, TV, they're kind of dominated by certain languages as well. So the internet's kind of just coming along at a stage in this process that's been happening for decades.
Right, and there's thought to be sort of a critical mass at which the internet no longer needs to support any more languages, which is around 100. So Facebook estimates that for, I think, 80% of the world's population to be able to understand the internet, you only need to support 92 languages. So getting the other 20% of people online is a case of either going after more languages like Hindi, which are very underrepresented online considering the number of people that speak them, or targeting smaller languages. Now, the linguistic experts I spoke to pointed out that there is absolutely no point in targeting these smaller languages because they are small for a reason. So you might have a language that's spoken by only a very small number of remote villages. Those people are going to communicate to each other face-to-face. They're not going to do it on Facebook. When they communicate on Facebook, if they do, they will do it on one of the global languages of the internet.
I mean, I already feel on the internet that people are speaking a slightly different language to me on certain social networks, which is young person.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is a different language. And Kari, you're as a young person, do you feel like you speak in a different language to older, greyer people like us on the internet?
Personally, I don't think I speak in a different language, but we did have that test a few weeks ago about the different codes that people are using on the internet and whether older people are understanding those. And to be honest, I didn't know most of those, so maybe I'm not young enough.
Right, and you have people that are complete polyglots, right? So they'll speak English and Spanish and Arabic and maybe another language. And they communicate in all of them when they speak. So now they're communicating in all of them when they're online. And this is part of the point that one of the linguistic experts I was speaking to was making, that the UN's saying, yes, linguistic diversity is lacking online, and it is because the internet is overwhelmingly English, but people are communicating in ways that can't be measured. And that's the wonderful thing about the internet and communication, is that people can break the rules of grammar, spelling, syntax, language, everything, and come up with new ways of talking to each other.
I guess the other thing is that part of the reason that a lot of these very small languages exist is that people historically were split apart from a main population, lived either on an island or somewhere inaccessible, and developed own languages because they weren't coordinating and communicating with the rest of the world. And the internet is very much like that as well. I mean, the growth of languages like Klingon, that's a Star Trek thing, but that's because that community is relatively tight-knit. It can create its own rules, reinforce them, and speak them within that community. The internet's quite good at hiving off small groups of people and allowing them to speak almost exclusively to each other, at least in that space. So it's possible we could see very specific languages on the model of these obscure Peruvian languages developing, over the next few decades on the internet as things become more rigid and people become more specified.
Right, and you almost see that through the creation of memes and in-jokes, and if you go on websites like Tumblr, there's a very specific way of speaking, writing, that tends to not involve much punctuation. Some words won't even be spaced out, and that's unique to that website. So there are already unique, almost dialects online appearing, so who knows if the internet's around for 100, 200, 300 more years, how language will change. But in terms of addressing the digital divide, as we call it, getting people in West Africa and Southeast Asia online, poor people in poor countries, it's not that they can't understand and read the internet. The fundamental problem is that they can't afford to get online. The infrastructure isn't there, the technology isn't there, and that, according to everyone I've spoken to about this topic of linguistic diversity online, is the main problem: access.
And that's pretty much that's also true with media, right? In as much as Hollywood had the money to make movies that were watched around the world, and even if they were dubbed, you know, English was the audible language that people were listening to. And that gap is impossible to make up. You know, you can't necessarily instantly create a film industry in West Africa. So America and to some extent Britain and the other countries in Europe dominate that form of media. And the same thing seems to be happening with the internet. Kara, if your story this week is anything to go by, we might not need language at all to communicate with each other.
No. So the University of Washington researchers at the Institute of Learning and Brain Science managed to connect two brains this week in a game of 20 questions.
Telepathic 20 questions.
Yes, telepathic 20 questions.
But this is two brains directly communicated to each other.
Yeah, so the people...
Were they in the same room? How did it work?
No, so the people were in two rooms a mile apart and weren't allowed any verbal communication. It was just through thinking.
So their two brains were hooked up and they played the game that we all know and love, 20 questions. But how successful was it?
So I think the success rate was quite high. In 75% of the games, they got it right. And the uncertainty there was whether they'd actually seen this flash of light, which is what is needed to determine a yes answer in the person who is guessing.
Okay, so let's take a step back. How did the experiment work and what's the flash of light?
So the person who has chosen their topic and is being asked the questions is hooked up to an ECG machine, which records electrical brain activity. And they had to just focus on a yes or no label on a computer screen. And that creates enough different activity that can send a signal to the person asking the question and let them know whether it was a yes or a no. And it did that through something called a transcranial magnetic stimulation coil.
I love it.
And that sort of just sat on the back of the head and looked like a big plastic key. It would trigger a flash of white light in front of the person's eyes in the event of a yes answer.
And this isn't the first time. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. just to pause for thought there. This isn't the first time that scientists have connected together two brains, but it is the first time that they've done it so complicatedly in humans, right?
Yeah, well, there was one experiment by the same group a couple of years ago, and they managed to connect two brains of people playing a video game. So one brain managed to control the finger of someone else through brain-to-brain connection.
Okay. I mean, I do love these stories. I mean, it reminds me, a few years ago, there was a story about rats being connected together to make a kind of giant super rat.
A super brain of rats.
A super rat brain. I mean, the weird thing is that we use the word brain to talk about this. I mean, they are people. The brains were with it. It wasn't brains in a jar.
Yeah,
was
I
it?
Found
was
that
it?
Weird.
That's amazing.
No. So it's almost their consciousnesses. Consciousness eyes.
So what are the like potential uses of this kind of technology?
Well, so their research now is moving into brain tutoring, which is where you can use one, high-powered brain, say, to train another brain. So, for example, what they're looking into is using an ADHD patient and a non-ADHD person and trying to make the ADHD person more focused by connecting their brains.
So could I connect my brain to the brain of my mother's incredibly stupid cockapoo puppy?
I'm not sure how it's going to work across animals.
It sounds like a fun weekend project, though. I think you should definitely
absolutely.
Try it.
I'm going to go and see her in a couple of weeks. So I'll get an ECG machine and a something coil, and away we go. I just want to take a quick step back. You skipped over something in your notes which really grabbed my attention. Three monkeys were connected to an avatar arm that they could then control. So do you mean the three monkeys worked together to control an arm?
Yeah, so they were hooked up and then they were able to move this arm up and down, which has weird implications for the future of sci-fi films.
I suppose the weird thing with this kind of technology is that in some ways it's simpler than it sounds, in that we're basically, we know so little about how the brain responds to different thoughts that really we're looking for a digital signal, effectively an on-off switch. So, you know, you're talking about the light that flashes in the case of a yes answer, or these monkeys presumably making the arm go up or down, but that's pretty much it. And it brings to mind another story we did this week about a paraplegic man who was taught to directly control his own limbs with his brain for the first time and walk again, even though he had suffered a spinal cord injury that meant he couldn't walk under his own power. And the way that worked was he basically had to be trained to think walk or not walk. And by recognizing the difference in those signals, the system he was wearing could send electrical pulses to his muscles that would then walk. But, you know, the problem is that if you try and do anything more complicated other than just walk or not walk, if you try and turn or balance or do any of the other many things that the body does naturally when you're walking, the computer gets completely confused because we can't understand the complexity of that signal.
But there's also a limit with the walking thing and with the 20 questions thing to how well people's brains are trained to send signals to these systems. So with the 20 questions thing, once they actually started doing the proper tests, they've been using the system for a while. So they were able to think very clearly, yes, 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 and direct their brain thoughts. And I imagine it would be the same thing with the paraplegic man, would have done an awful lot of training just to get to the point where his brain can clearly send a signal saying, walk, 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 walk.
That's right. The process for that particular test took 19 weeks.
It's incredible.
And he was initially just working on a computer and then had to be suspended above the ground to train his legs to be able to recognize the signal. And only then could he then be put on the ground and walk. Obviously, he went through a lot of muscle training as well because he hadn't used his legs in many years, but eventually was able to take steps with the power of his brain, which is amazing. But it kind of underlines what little we know about the brain. You know, when we walk from one desk to another, there are 20 different things going on, most of them unconsciously, and we don't have the ability to distinguish those signals effectively right now. Part of that is the technology. So, you know, I guess in this case, they were using an ECG cap. That was also true in the test with a paraplegic walker. But we've written about on Wired many times, particularly in the magazine, about systems like BrainGate, which conceivably would give us much finer detail of thoughts coming from the brain and the ability to put thoughts back into the brain.
Yeah, it's the limit of the brain-to-computer interface that we're still lacking. As you say, we don't understand the brain. And from the very profound to the slightly less profound world of virtual reality, Michael, this week you went to Birmingham to the Eurogamer Expo.
That's true. EGX is the UK's biggest gaming show. 80,000 people show up to play hundreds of video games from all different types of developers and parts of the industry. I was there as part of something else I'm doing along with Wired UK, which is the BBC Make It Digital campaign. So you can listen to that on iPlayer if you like. Sorry, super plug there.
Which radio station, Michael?
BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live.
Yeah. No, but it was fun. And, you know, I think we're getting to the point basically with virtual reality that as it's coming up more and more as a concept in the mainstream media. And, you know, I've been going on different shows over the last week basically talking about this over and over, about what is virtual reality, is it mainstream, and is it something that's just for gamers, or can it be used for kids and older people and families?
And you got hit in the face.
And I got hit in the face. So I just wanted to tell, I like getting out this story. I've been trying to tell as many people as possible because it was embarrassing and it makes me feel good to get it out. But I got punched in the face on BBC One.
By Bradley Walsh.
By Bradley Walsh.
On the One Show.
On the One Show.
With really, your mother watching.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, he didn't make a huge amount of contact. But so this was a bit where I was talking about virtual reality. You know, what is virtual reality? Is it mainstream? Can gamers do it? Is it for other people too? But Bradley Walsh, meanwhile, was wearing a PlayStation VR headset next to me, going through a demo called, I think it's called Into the Deep, where basically you're under the ocean and then a shark shows up. And that's supposed to be scary.
Turns out he's scared of sharks.
Well, no, I mean, turns out he's a complete performer.
That's one word.
Yeah, and obviously wanted to make it funny. So he was flailing around as much as possible, even when nothing was really going on. But obviously he's wearing a headset, so he hit me in the face.
It's comedy gold.
Well, yeah, that's one way of putting it.
But back to the expo.
I wanted to linger on
some
that
of your highlights?
Well, so I tried out HTC Vive again and got a lot more time on Tilt Brush, which is my absolute favorite virtual reality thing. So all of the virtual reality demos you usually get are basically you're under the ocean, something shows up, or you're kind of playing with robots or doing other typical video game stuff. But, you know, Tilt Brush is completely different. You're in a virtual room, and because HTC Vive can tell where you are, you can walk around that room. But you basically have a virtual paintbrush, and you can create arcs of light and sculptures in midair, and it's absolutely amazing.
It's like the best trip you ever had.
It's stunning. Like, it really is. And it's something that's creative and not just passive. You know, it's not just entertainment or gaming. It feels like a completely different form of creativity. There's a video on our site of a Disney animator, whose name briefly escapes me, drawing characters from The Little Mermaid and other films he's worked on in this system in virtual reality. And it is absolutely lovely to see someone working, because you can move your arm in physical space and see light emerge from the end of it. It really is cool.
What do you think, Cara? So a lot of the early virtual reality stuff is shooting stuff in the face, but now we're seeing artistic things. Netflix and Oculus have announced a virtual living room where you can sit down and watch your favorite films and TV shows. Is virtual reality finally making a play for less of the hardcore gamers?
I still wonder, with things like the Netflix living room, how that works in a social environment, because often you find...
Oh, no one's going to socialise anymore.
We will just watch TV on our own. I quite enjoy...
You'll have virtual friends, sorry.
I quite enjoy the activity of watching TV with someone else, so you can, you know, comment, be annoying, that sort of thing.
Right, and this was kind of the problem with 3D TV as well, wasn't it? No one wanted to wear a silly pair of goggles while they're sitting down with their friends.
Yeah, and we could never find the batteries anywhere. So it was so pointless.
It's true. I mean, I think particularly with the Netflix thing, you know, that probably is going to be a niche thing, or maybe something you do on a plane. But yep. Oculus specifically, and other headset makers are looking at ways to make it more social. So Oculus has its touch controllers, which give you so much fine control. You can play catch with another person and really kind of interact, because your hands become a physical presence within the virtual world.
But I can also play catch with a ball.
Yeah, but you can't do it from across the ocean. But a PlayStation,
beautiful.
But PlayStation as well are making specific games where one person wears the virtual reality headset, other people are playing on the TV with controllers and can interact that way. So, you know, it becomes more like the Wii, something you're sharing and kind of engaging with together.
So you can play the Wii across the sea.
Yeah. Well, I asked some of these questions of a couple of people involved in VR at EGX. So Dan O'Brien, who's HTC's Executive Director of Connected Products, was telling me how VR can become truly mainstream. I also spoke to Patrick O'Lunay, founder and CEO of NDreams Limited, who are making a bunch of video games for VR, and Ollie Walsh, who's editor of Eurogamer, kind of looking at where VR is up to and where it's going to go in the next year.
So we've just tried HTC Vive. It's a really intense and immersive demo. What kind of reactions do people have to it?
It's the best part of my day, is watching people come out of a demo experience and just seeing their reactions, seeing their mind actually expand right in front of you about what are the possibilities of a Vive, you know, of a VR experience, and how real it is, and how much you can do with either gaming or non-gaming and lots of different content. People's minds begin to just flip right away to all the possibility.
How good is VR going to get? Are we going to feel like we really are transported to other worlds?
I believe so. I absolutely believe so. It depends a lot on, you know, the content developer that's going to develop for that solution and what they want to bring and how believable they want to make that solution. But yes, I mean, we can make you believe that you're 150 feet underwater in, you know, the blue, you know, demo with Weaver. You know, we can make believe you're in a cockpit, you know, with the new Frontier, you know, demo experience that we're doing today. Some of them are very, you're going to have a lot of different experiences, but I think we can actually make people believe they're walking around the pyramids of Giza and going to see them for the first time in their life.
One other thing people might worry about is you're putting on a headset. It's a pretty solitary experience. Mm-hmm. How do you turn this into something that isn't just going to make us more isolated?
That's a good question. I think there's a social aspect of VR that's going to come, you know, with this, where a lot of developers are thinking about creating those environments where you're interacting with other people that are in their VR space. You guys are meeting in your VR space, so it doesn't feel that, you know, single, you know, by yourself. Or you know, I think a lot of people are going to be developing for those social experiences, and that's going to come out very quickly.
I also spoke to Patrick O'Lunay, founder and CEO of NDreams Limited, who are making a bunch of video games for VR, and Ollie Walsh, who's editor of Eurogamer, kind of looking at where VR is up to and where it's going to go in the next year.
Hi, I'm Ollie Walsh, and I'm the editor of Eurogamer.net.
Hi, I'm Patrick O'Lunay, and I'm the CEO of NDreams.
So VR is still very new, but there are lots of headsets in development. How close are we to this being something that you can really go out and buy?
It feels to us like we're, you know, March, April time is really when it's going to hit its peak. Oculus have announced that, you know, they're going to be launching Q1, Sony PlayStation VR, Q1, Q2, first half of next year, and the HTC Vive, the other kind of high-end VR headset, will be launching a soft launch end of this year, but I think realistically in big numbers for consumers around about March as well. So that's really when it all happens.
And Patrick, you're developing games for VR, but this is a medium most people haven't tried yet. How do you go about trying to make experiences people actually want to play?
One of the hardest things is getting the message across to people what VR, what VR is like. You really need to try it. You know, when you use VR, the magic of VR is you feel presence. You feel like you've been teleported into somewhere else. Rather than spectating through a TV screen or a phone screen, you're actually inside the experience. And that makes emotions so much more rich and much more powerful. So fear and happiness and excitement and confusion and all those kind of things are much richer because you believe you're there. And so it's getting that message across to people is I guess, one of the key challenges we've got.
Do you remember the first time that you felt that excitement about putting on a VR headset and being in a different world?
I do, very vividly, yeah. So a couple of years ago, we got to see the first Oculus DK1, and we got a very early look at the Sony Morpheus, as it was called back then, and I basically flipped. I'd seen VR headsets back in the 90s, Virtuality and the VFX, and you know they were, the idea was great, but you turned your head and it took half a second for them to catch up, and the resolution was awful, and they felt horrible. And now the display technologies and the motion tracking and everything else in the headsets is so good. It's such a comfortable, you know, really immersive experience.
So Ollie, you're editor of Eurogamer, you've tried every virtual reality headset there is. Presumably you also tried the versions in the 90s. Do you remember the first time it clicked for you as a commercial product that this is really going to take off?
So there was a really exciting moment for me about 3 or 4 years ago when I was pulled into a meeting at E3, the big game industry show in Los Angeles, with John Carmack, the legendary programmer of Doom and Quake. And he was showing this strange homebrew kit that he had got off a guy called Palmer Luckey, who turned out to be the creator of Oculus, and he'd written some code for it, and he was really keen to show it off with the new version of Doom 3 that they were demoing at the time. And I got to try it, and Carmack was giving me all of this techno babble about how he'd used software that he'd written for rocketry to really, really increase the sensitivity of the headset so that it could track movement very quickly, and how this was central to the VR experience. And a lot of this flew over my head, but as soon as I put the headset on and tried it, although that version was much lower resolution than the ones that are going to hit the market next year, I instantly knew what he meant. It was all about field of vision, and it was all about how quick it was. And it was a really thrilling experience. So there was that, and then just earlier this year, I got to try HTC Vive, powered by Steam VR. And the difference with that is that it allows you to walk around a room and explore 3D space. And that, for me, really opened my eyes to how this was going to create a very new kind of entertainment software, a new kind of gaming.
And Patrick, what are you most excited about people playing and experiencing from the stuff you're building in your game studio?
I think I'm most excited about the fact that there are new types of gameplay mechanics and new genres, I think, even will come out of VR. It's not just first person. You know, we're doing a first person adventure as our first game, and that's great. People love exploring in VR and looking under things and behind things, and kind of makes full use of that. But there will be other genres, and it doesn't have to be through the eyes of the character. You know, there are dioramas. If you see a beautiful detail kind of model in VR, you can move your head towards it and away from it and actually pick up characters and move them around and look around. And this will allow us to do new kinds of games that we haven't done before. So we're experimenting with different types of gameplay that we haven't seen on other devices, and I think that's what's really exciting.
All very interesting, Michael, but what do you think? You spent more time on VR than Carl or I. Is it the future? Are we starting to get there?
It's really immersive and really impressive, and I think everyone who tries it really has a great experience. To be honest, I haven't seen the game that I'm going to want to spend more than 20 minutes inside VR to play. And these are going to be expensive systems. Although the new Gear VR, which was announced yesterday, is less than £100.
And will work with any phone.
And works with any Samsung phone. Really, that is more, I think, on the model of a kind of a posh Google Cardboard. So it's good for 360 videos, short games, short experiences. But it's not high enough quality necessarily that you're going to want to use it for a long time. Oculus looks a lot better, but you're going to need a fairly expensive PC, and the system itself is going to cost many hundreds of pounds. That same is also true of PlayStation VR. So it's going to be a big investment, and unless the games are there, it's hard to see how it necessarily immediately becomes a mainstream thing.
All right, straw poll. Who is going to want a VR system for Christmas? Well, the only one you'll be able to get is
HTC. Yeah.
So who's going to be getting an HTC Vive for Christmas? Put your hands up. This will work well in audio. No one has put their hands up.
Well,
Maybe next year.
Maybe next year. Still to come, Matt Hancock, MP and Cabinet Minister, tells Wired why digitising everything you do in your daily life is a great way to save money, not a great way to enable the most devastating hack of all time. This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're working on a mobile app or website and searching for a simple payment solution, Braintree V.0 allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards and more, all with a simple integration. Just one snippet of code and you're all set up, ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. For information and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com now. Braintree can't wait to see what you make of it. So, at the end of last week, I went down to the Cabinet Office in Whitehall and met up with Matt Hancock, MP, who is the Cabinet Minister and also is in charge of digital government, and kind of chatted about all things digital.
Let's do some scene setting here. So, yeah. This is the government being digital, but it's doing it in a very government-y way.
Well, it also comes in the context of trying to reform the civil service, which in the current government means firing a lot of the civil service.
Right.
So, the idea is to reduce costs by putting some of the most basic services that we interact with every day online, and reinforcing design principles and mobile principles that mean we can actually do them simply and easily.
I want you to talk about Matt Hancock's desk.
Yeah, we're going to get there. but I think it's first to say there are roughly 700 ways that we interact with government through the course of our lives, whether trying to register births, deaths and marriages, to trying to get a driving license or work with the NHS. And so the whole idea here is to digitise a lot of that and make it simpler and easier to interact with. So that was the topic of the conversation. But obviously, the Cabinet Office is a weird place. A lot of it is still seemingly the palace that was built by Henry VIII in the 16th century. So it's this weird old building, but yet surrounded by modern offices, and half of it's been knocked down 7 times and rebuilt. So I went into Matt Hancock's office, and he was working on a standing desk on a MacBook Air, but it was a standing desk made of mahogany.
Rich mahogany.
Yeah. So it was just like a perfect metaphor of the most hipster thing you could do, which is work at a standing desk, and the most old-fashioned Tory party thing, which is to work on a mahogany desk. It just managed to fuse the two. It almost felt suspicious. But he did wax lyrical about Apple, actually. He said, if procurement works at its best, we would all buy, the government would buy all Apple Mac stuff because it works better.
The clinking of glasses in Cupertino can be heard from here.
Yeah, I mean, and some of the things he said actually sounded like they could have been said on the stage at an Apple event, with that same mixture of kind of optimism mixed with a slight suspicion that the real world might not work like this. So a lot of it is about trying to create user experiences that people love and simplify people's lives. And that, in a sense, that does make sense. It would be better if getting a driver's license was quicker and easier to apply for online, which it is, and the cost has gone down by 36% over the last year.
Yeah, well, let's look at places where the government's actually done some good stuff here. So we all voted in the last general election, I presume.
Yep.
Did we all register to vote online? Did we use the online system?
Yeah, from America I did, actually.
Well, there you go. And it was good. The gov.uk register vote online system worked pretty well. Got everyone that needed to be on the electoral register on it. And just, it didn't break.
That was the big thing.
Which is the biggest deal when you're setting up a huge government digital service, that it just works. And it stays up. And there was a huge, huge rush of people to register to vote at the last minute. We covered it on Wired. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in the last few days and few hours signing up to get on the electoral register. And the system didn't go down once.
Yeah, and Gov.UK actually did win, just in design terms, it won a design award in 2013 that was well deserved. I think it's widely regarded as a good website that's sort of clean and very simple to navigate.
Yeah, and when you compare it to all government websites, it's remarkable that they managed to make something so good when they made things that were just so, so bad.
And I think this is one of the things that I brought up with Matt, is that Matt, the minister, it's just that government is way more complicated than we really give it credit for. It sounds easy when you say there are 700 basic services. But for instance, James, I think this week or the end of last week, you were covering one government agency website that had serious security problems.
Right. So the press regulator that was set up towards the end of last year when they got rid of the old regulator has a lovely website, which just happens to have a very basic security flaw where you can put executable code into the search box and get it to return a page on the website that doesn't necessarily exist. So you can get it to display text and images So we rigged the page to have a picture of a pig's head saying how easy it was to hack the website, which might be sort of somewhat politically damaging for them because it looks like it's on their website. And that was a problem for hundreds and hundreds of government, NHS, police, security services websites that I found a couple of years ago, and it's still a problem now.
And in a way, one of the tricky things with this, particularly for the Conservatives, is that it's easier to manage a lot of this stuff if you centralise it, but centralising a lot of government isn't necessarily what the Tory party would stand for. So the reason this interview came up is that the minister, along with various other members of the government, is on a week-long trip to America.
That's nice.
Fact-finding, but also to set up a fellowship program where experts from both countries will swap and learn from each other, which isn't the kind of thing that one should be cynical about at all.
I'm going to get on my ranty horse.
Okay, I'm just going to give you just give me a second.
I'm going to take a while to mount it. Carry on.
it's a very small room we're recording in, so I hope it's a small ranty horse. But so one of the things he was doing was meeting companies like Uber and various companies involved in the blockchain and Bitcoin, because I think he is interested in looking at those models for how government can function. But that brings up a big point, which is that obviously the Conservative Party is pretty focused on the idea of smaller government and a smaller civil service and firing a lot of the civil service. There are planned cuts of, I think, up to 100,000 civil service jobs being lost before 2020, 10 billion in budget cuts by the end of 2018. So digitizing can often be a great excuse for firing people, can be done quite quickly. But also in terms of the blockchain, we were talking specifically about how the blockchain could replace elements of a central bank or core parts of the economy, which is great until that goes disastrously wrong. Or, you know, and do we want to give up responsibility for those core parts of government? Do we want to emulate Uber and turn everyone into an employee, have this distributed system rather than something for which someone can ultimately take responsibility? And taking responsibility for things that screw up is a big reason we employ people in government. So, you know, there aren't necessarily direct parallels. And obviously, the idea of hiving off bits of the civil service to private companies just because they say they can run them more efficiently actually has a lot of downsides. So, James, off
I am
you go.
I am fully mounted on my ranting pony now. What I find a little bit curious here is that they've gone to America. We're a country that's in Europe. We've got some great examples of digital stateship in the European Union and closer than America, definitely.
Such as Estonia,
where you can become an e-resident. They've got this huge government digital service. They're seen as a world leader in it. So why is Matt Hancock and his group of cronies hopping over to San Francisco? Because it makes good headlines, right?
Well, no. I mean, I think they would say that a huge amount of the technology industry is focused there. You know, a huge amount of the experts, particularly experts from around the world, come to Silicon Valley for a good reason. And you know,
but they're also right on our doorstep.
Yeah, but I mean, we do talk to those people quite constantly, and you know, the relationship that the Tory Party has had with Tech City, both the organization and the sort of vague general concept. That represents London's still booming, really, technology industry is kind of quite complicated. I think one of the other reasons they went to the US is obviously it's an enormous government democracy, and they've also been through an absolutely disastrous experience with digital government, with healthcare.
Which didn't work.
But I think there's a legitimate point, which is that now has got up on its feet. They've been through a huge disaster and come out the other side, and learning from that is actually pretty valuable.
Right, but there is, I'm getting on my ranting pony again, there is an obsession, I'm going to make this a thing, there is an obsession with British politics to look at American politics. An awful lot of the people that were brought in to run the election campaigns for the Conservatives and the Labour Party were either from Australia or America, more so from America. There is an obsession with going to Harvard to study politics and getting all of our knowledge, or a lot of our knowledge, from America. And it would be nice to see the government and politics embracing some of the great ideas that are coming up in the more interesting parts of Europe. Just saying.
Oh, I think it's a fair point. You know, and I think the value of a week-long trip to Silicon Valley can easily be debated. I think, does the minister necessarily have to go, or can he just send someone who's, you know, maybe already there and working for the government? I mean, Britain has an extensive diplomatic service across the US.
There's a consulate in the San Francisco Bay. They could just send someone from there. But I'm sure they'll have a lovely time and they'll learn a lot. And you do learn by going to places. That's definitely true. So did Hancock seem like a bit of a Chancer or someone that actually knew what he was talking about?
I mean, it's hard to say. I think the wider context of what's happening in terms of cuts to the civil service and other government agencies is absolutely central to it. I think it's a difficult job in an attempt to make something positive out of something that could be very negative. I think you also get a sense of it's not enough for one person to turn this oil tanker around. I think attempts to reform the civil service are incredibly long-standing. It's one of those things, a bit like cutting red tape, that has been said dozens of times across the decades and really doesn't necessarily mean anything that specific. And it feels like the kind of thing that's going to take a lot longer than 5 years to get done. However, I do think there are some clear positive things a government could do to make it easier, for instance, to get passports, get driving licenses, do those kind of basic administrative tasks, and also to improve our democracy. I think registering to vote online was widely regarded as a good thing.
Voting online.
Exactly. I mean, the more we can do to open up access to the core parts of government, such as, for instance, paying your tax, which is incredibly hard at the moment, or getting your benefits, which is also incredibly hard at the moment. You know, those are relatively antiquated systems. We could improve those and give people more access to knowledge about things they're entitled to, and that would improve government too. But, you know, I think it's hard to say. He's only been in the post a few months. Politics aside, he, seems like a decent fellow. He's, he has a nice laptop, so that's good.
And a lovely mahogany desk.
But, it's just an interesting chat. Anyway, the full interview is up on why.co.uk right now. So head over there to read it in full. Cara, what do you think? You've lived in the States and presumably had to deal with the incredibly arcane healthcare system. Do you think there's stuff we can learn from America?
Well, my experience applying for my visa, and there were lots of forms that you could fill out online and lots of tax forms you could fill out online and things as well, is that they like to charge for it all. So they'd get you to fill out this form quickly. Oh, but you can't submit it until you pay $100. And so you've spent $500 to fill out these forms online. So it depends what cost it's going to come, whether it's going to cost us a lot of money to do this, and then where those savings will come from.
Can we touch on one more thing?
Sure.
Procurement.
Right.
It's a boring sounding word, but it's actually quite important. Let's take a stat from 2014. The government spent £5.5 million supporting computers still running Windows XP after Microsoft dropped technical support. £5.5 million.
They have stopped that now.
Way to go. But it's a sign of, as you said, it's an oil tanker that's kind of stuck in a swamp somewhere on fire.
Yeah, and one of the other big things is enabling startups to pitch to government for contracts on the same level as big companies, because the financial investment needed to actually even pitch for these kind of things, because often you're giving services or giving a huge chunk of that contract without necessarily getting the money immediately.
Right, it's in good faith.
Right. It makes it hard for startups to compete. So you end up going for older, bigger, more established companies because they're the only ones who can bid. And for that, Matt Hancock really didn't have a very good answer. He basically said, we're trying to improve that.
Right, and when you've got a government that's championing things like Tech City, for it to then go, yeah, but we're not going to actually use any of your technologies. We'll keep on using Microsoft and HP and Cisco and Fujitsu because they're big and we kind of trust them, and they can foot the bill if it goes wrong.
The other problem is that, obviously, with all government services, you have to maintain 100% accessibility. So you can't switch to a system that, for instance, only works on computers with certain browsers that have recently been updated, because some people are going to be trying to access them on Windows 3.1. Like, you have to make it as simple as possible. And some of the cooler stuff that maybe Estonia is doing, for instance, I keep saying Estonia because that seems like an obvious pun.
It's great.
We can't replicate because the population is too much, is much, much bigger. We can't fully transition the whole of government all at one time. It's an older country as well. We've got so many systems that have been in place for decades.
There'd be no point in putting pensions on an iPhone app.
Right. So, I think that's hard. But, it's true. When there's another stat that's linked to in our piece that maintaining one PC costs £7,000 for the government.
Outrage. But as you pointed out when I pointed this out to you the other day, well, it probably actually costs most companies quite a lot of money to maintain a computer for an entire year.
Yeah.
It's not just a case of buying a computer for £1,000 and then just letting it sit there. There's software costs, subscription costs, maintenance costs, et cetera, et cetera.
And staff, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, it, you know, and insurance. So, you know, it's more expensive than it sounds, but, you know, hopefully there's some stuff we can do without being too brutal in terms of the actual people who do a good job working for the civil service already.
Well, let's keep an eye on this. Let's see what the government does over the next 4 years with digital procurement and Bitcoin and blockchain and Uber and God knows what else. And we'll see, we'll have this conversation again in 4 years and we'll see if Matt Hancock has lived up to the hype.
Yeah. So as ever on the Wired podcast, we love your feedback and we love your questions. You can send us a question anytime you like on Twitter. We're at Wired UK. James, you're at JT Temperton.
JT Emperton. Yes.
JT Emperton. I'm at Michael Rundle. Cara.
At CJ McGugan.
So you can ask us a question on there. You can also email podcast@wired.co.uk. We do have one question this week from Ed Hayes. He asks, do we see the Surface 4, which is set to be announced October 6th, I believe, by Microsoft in an event in New York. Do we see the Surface 4 being a flop compared to the iPad Pro? Better hardware, but let down by software quality.
Michael, as Wired's resident Surface fanatic, what do you think?
I don't know. I think they're still very different products. Surface 4 Pro 4 will be a full Windows laptop and have a lot of the issues that that means it has to deal with, such as higher battery consumption, not being able to have that instant on side of things, but it does have, you know, full compatibility with all of the programs that you would want to use in your daily life.
Whereas it's a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, so the iPad, I think, is still going to be a relatively you know, simplified machine. You can now multitask, you can run apps side by side, you can have Twitter pulled in as a sidebar, and obviously the pen, the Apple Pencil, is going to provide really good pen input, which is the thing I love the Surface most for. But it's still going to be quite different things. I'm not sure I'd fully want to transition to an iPad Pro as my main machine. And the cost of them, I think, is almost equivalent. The iPad Pro, I think, could cost up to $1,000. Maybe, I think it's £799 for the higher model. But, I mean, that's a lot of money. And, you know, you could get a really, really good laptop for that. And you could get a Surface Pro 3 for that. So,
right. But as Johnny Ive would tell you, it's a truly revolutionary piece of technology. The iPad Pro looks great. The Surface is, as you say, a really, really good option for people that want a full Windows laptop, but with the portability. So they're really different products. It's almost apples and oranges.
I suppose so. I mean, you know, I think ultimately I feel like computing is going the more of the iPad direction than the Surface direction. And Windows 10 is, you know, the whole point is to resolve that kind of problem of having a computer that's both touch and non-touch. And they still haven't quite figured that out. You know, the iPad is a very consistent, rigorous, safe, secure operating system.
Which one do you reckon Matt Hancock would use?
I don't think he'd use a Surface. I just don't think you'd want to associate yourself with the brand. I think it would be an iPad Pro.
He's an iPad Pro man. What about you, Cara? Are you Apple? Are you mad Apple?
Yeah, I converted last year and I don't think that I'd go back to PC now.
But do you use a laptop?
I actually started using my iPad a lot more now.
Ah.
Yeah, my laptop doesn't really get a show.
What about the listeners? Do you still use a laptop? Is it an knackered old HP? Is it a MacBook? Is it a Surface? Are you going to be buying an iPad Pro and using the keyboard with that? How are you going to be getting stuff done on the go for the rest of the year?
And actually, on a wider point, we're getting to that point in the year where it's all about products. You know, we've had the big Apple announcements. We know all about that. Our iPhone review is on the website now as well, by the way. Plug. But, you know, we're going to see big announcements from Microsoft, Google. Amazon made an announcement last week. You know, there's a lot of other companies coming up, and obviously it's coming towards Christmas, so a lot of people are going to be buying technology. What do you care about in products? You know, let's get old-fashioned tech producty
it's
for a
September.
Second.
It's September. It's not coming towards Christmas.
It is coming towards Christmas.
Quiet.
It'll be there. I get married in a week, and then after that is Christmas, basically.
Yeah, pretty
in
much.
My head.
Put the tree up.
Yeah. So, yeah. What are you excited about? What do you want to use? What do you want to buy? Tell us. At YGK. And we will see you again next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.